Morning. Today's daf in Sanhedrin's Memtes. We are Memchesam and Alf. We're halfway down in the Amud. We are in the middle of the sugya of Hazmana, whether it's Milsa or Lav Milsa, whether or not designation of an item gives it its status. Machlokes between Abai and Rava. Rava is of the opinion that when you're Mazmin, that when you designate something but you don't actually use it for that designation as of yet, so it doesn't gain status. It only will gain status when you both designate it and you use it. According to Abaye, no, designation by itself creates a hazmana. Designation by itself creates a status. And just by mere designation, so then that gives it status. Designation is done verbally. So the Gemara doesn't say it. Gemara doesn't spell that out. But presumably, yeah. Designation is done simply by verbal designation. Second Tosfos on Memches, discusses that very point. But that's the machlokes between Abaye and Rava. And we're in the middle of the Gemara's discussion in terms of whether or not Hazman is Milso, Lav Milso, whether designation by itself is considered significant or not. We are on Memches, and Alf, we're halfway down in the Amud, and we are continuing in the Gemara's discussion. The Gemara noted yesterday that Rav's position coordinates with Rav Chissa's position, which just... It's just a connection. I don't think it connects the 2 points. But Rav was married to the daughter of Rav Chista. But either way, that just happens to be in this case. I don't think that's why their positions are connected. But anyway, the Gemara points out that Rav and Rav Chista's position coordinate because Rav Chista brought down the halacha regarding a tefillin bag. Someone has a tefillin bag made for them, but they haven't used it yet. So the tefillin bag does not have the status of Tashmisha Kedusha. And so therefore, you could use it for mundane activities. Once, however, you use it for the tefillin, so then now it has a status of Kedusha, Tashmisha Kedusha, and you can't use it anymore for anything other than the tefillin. But that's the halach of Rav Chista. So Rav Chista falls in line together with Rava. That hazmana by itself is not significant. It's hazmana plus... plus actual usage, and that's going to give it its status. Tashma, the Gemara, now continuing, the Gemara Amem Chesam and Alf. It's about 15 lines from the top of the Amud, and Nefesh Shabana L'Shem. So here we're going to go now over a number of different brises that are going to seem to either support Rav or Abaye's position, and you know, this is a classic way the Gemara is going to present this Machlokas. Rai is in each direction. At the end of the discussion, the Gemara is going to also resolve who the Halacha, in fact, follows. Just also one other note before we go on to the Gemara. So the towards the top of the Amud, when the Gemara started this discussion, not the very beginning of the discussion, but towards the top of the Amud, you can actually see it inside right here in our Amud, about 5 lines from the top of the Amud, the Gemara gives simanim, like a mnemonic to help you remember all the cases coming up. It is an interesting one. I didn't point this out yesterday, but it's an oddity, because generally speaking, what the simanim do is it provides the headings for all the cases that are listed. So it's interesting because... it's not a comprehensive list of all the cases that we're going to be going through. And not only that, but it actually has names of cases that are not discussed. And that's just a rarity. That doesn't happen that often. But, okay, that mnemonic needs better understanding. Okay, but with all that stated, Tashma, in the Gemara, Nefesh Abana L'Shem Chai. Let's say you built a monument, right, like a tombstone, for somebody who's alive. Mutabana. So you're allowed to get benefit from it. But let's say after the person's dead, and now the tombstone is quote-unquote in usage, you know, because the person died, and then another row is added onto the tombstone. All right, whatever. They wanted to, okay, for whatever reason. They wanted to add more to the tombstone, so they actually added more tombstone. They add another row to this tombstone. So at that point in time, now it's also behana. So what's the impression that you get over here? Just the designation by itself is not sufficient, is not significant, and it's only upon usage that it becomes significant. So the Gemara says, "Hacha b'maiskin and derama b'meis." So the Gemara says, "Well, no. What happened over here is that it was both designated, and the mace was actually put in." So the Gemara says, well, if that's true, meaning that we're talking not only about designation of the tombstone, but also where the mace was inserted into the kever, and so now tombstone is not just designated, but used as well. So the Gemara says, so at that point in time, What's even the discussion? Meaning, what's the point? So the Gemara says that they was used, but the body was then exhumed. So in other words, what happened was is that it was prepared for the person before he died. So that was that's too early in advance. Then the person was placed in, but then the person was exhumed. Again, why? We don't know. But it does, for our purposes right now, that doesn't matter. So the Gemara says, Avagav de Panye. So the Gemara says, so now that he was put in and exhumed, so now, the original tombstone, that itself doesn't have any status. Why doesn't it have status? Because it wasn't put there after he died. It was only put there before he died. And even though it was used, but it was unused, I know that's strange language, but in other words, once the body was exhumed, it no longer is in usage. So the tombstone itself does not have the status of, we'll call it right now Tashmishi HaMeis, right? Items used for the mace. And then the only thing that will have status is that extra row that's on top. Why? Because that extra row that was on top, that was placed on specifically for the mace while the mace, after the mace died. So the Gemara says, So the Gemara says, so considering everything we just went over and the case that we just went over, it's an odd case, but considering now this case, if I were then to remove the top row that I added on after he died, so the rest of the tombstone would be mutter ba'na. You're allowed to get benefit from it. Tashma. Next case. So you dug up a gravesite for one's father, and then, confusion, miscommunication between the family members, and he was died in another plot. So now you have a prepared cemetery plot for your father that you never ended up using. So the halach is, you, the son, cannot be buried in that gravesite forever, and in perpetuity. Now, presumably, this gives us an indication that designation by itself is significant, meaning it wasn't used, it was just designated, so this gives us the impression that Hazman Milsehi, that just simple designation by itself is sufficient. The Gemara says no. Hasam Mishum Kvod Aviv. So the Gemara says no. That has nothing to do with the issues of Hazmanah, whether it's Milsa, Lav Milsa. This is an issue of Kibra Ve'im, right? One's honor that a person is obligated to have for one's father and one's mother. Once you dig up this burial plot for your father, even though it wasn't used, nevertheless, out of kibud av aim, you should not use it yourself. And this is the correct understanding of the brisa, and this is nothing to do with hazmana. And hakanami mistap, and the Gemara says, and I'll tell you what, if you think about it a little bit more, and you learn the second half of the brisa, this is the correct conclusion. Because the Tani Sefer, Mishum and Gamlil, Amar Afa Chotzef Avanim La'aviv, V'halach V'kivra B'makam Acher Harizel Eikaver. Even just quarrying the stones in preparation of the burial plot is something that once you do it for your father, so then you cannot use it for yourself forever. Now, right, Harizel Eikaver by Olamis. Now, Iyamar B'shalmim Mishum Kibra Aviv Shapir. Now, if this is all a halacha that is rooted in the principles of Kibbutz, so then perfectly understandable. Eliyamar Mishum Hazmana. So the Gemara says, but if you think this has something to do with our discussion of Hazmana, of designation, Tavil Ariga Mi'ikal Amanda Amar. So the Gemara says, look, we discussed in the very beginning of the whole discussion when we started yesterday, that if you weave Tachrichen for the mace, so that is the designation. But what if you just put the thread together, right? You spin the thread for the tachrichen, for the mace. That's pre. That's too early in advance. Meaning even a bayu who says that designation is significant, but that's designation right before usage. If it's anything that's pre, that's already too far in advance. Even a bayu will tell you that that's not significant. Here, if we're talking about quarrying of the stones is just a preparatory act for the preparatory act. It's too early in advance. Even a bayi would tell you that that's not hazmana, that's not considered any type of designation that gives it status. So, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's halacha over here, that quarrying stones for one's father, that's it, he cannot use it forever, it has to be, the only way to explain it, is that this is a function, this is rooted in the halachas of Kibud Av V'Aim. Gemara says, fine. So once again, this serves as no longer a proof, neither for Rav or for a bayi. Next case, Tashma. Kever chadash mutar bana. If you have a brand new cemetery plot, so you're allowed to get benefit from it prior to your usage of it. But once you put a bani in there, and even if it's a stillborn, but once you put a bani in there, so now it's not only designation, but it's usage, and now it's asabana. So here now, It seems to be a very clear proof of Rava. Because here we're talking about that it does not have any kind of status until usage. So the Gemara says, so the Gemara says, no. The way to understand this brisa goes like this. That really designation by itself gives it the status. So then why is the brisa talking about placing the nafel into the burial spot? Because when dealing with a nafel, it is actually up for a debate whether or not a nafel will give a cemetery plot a status. It happens to be the opinion of Shimon ben Gamliel that if you were to take a nafel and put it in a burial plot, it does not give it status. Meaning, a nafel is, in other words, you're not allowed to miscarry the nafel. That's a form of tzicha. But in terms of the actual nafel itself, it doesn't have enough of a status of a mace whereby which if I put it into a burial plot, it will give that burial plot status. That's the opinion of Shimon Gamliel. Tanakama obviously disagrees, but the Gemara says over here, this has nothing to do with designation, not designation. This has to do with a debate regarding how whether or not a nafel can give a burial plot status of something which is also by not. Tashma, the Gemara says, come and hear the following. Most are mace on a mace, and most are mace liyoshav. Okay, you make a collection, right? There's need for people to be buried, poor people to be buried. And so you, the Gabbai, now are making a collection, and there's a surplus. What do you do with the surplus? So you apply it towards other poor people who need to be buried. Now, most are mace liyoshav. Now, well, let's say you're collecting for one particular person, and you're clear about it, meaning the Gabbai goes around the community saying that this person died, and Rachmana, he doesn't have enough to afford a proper funeral, and I'm collecting for him. And he specifies over here, not for poor people in general and for the needs of burial for poor people in general, but specifically for him. And now there's a surplus. What do you do with the surplus? So the Brisa says that what you do with the surplus is you hand it over to the family. Now, handing it over to the family, how could that be? Meaning, by virtue of the fact that he collected that money, isn't that money muzman? Isn't it now designated for the purposes of burial? And if it's designated for the purpose of burial, you can't use it for other needs. So the Gemara says, "Hachma ma'iskin and shigavu mechayim." So the Gemara says the money was collected while he was alive. So now, again, meaning, even according to Abayi who says it's mana milsa, that's only a designation at right before the point you need it. But if it's in an earlier stage, even Abayi would say that that's not considered a designation. So the Gemara explains that this Bryce is talking about a case where the collection was done while he was alive. So the Gemara says, "Halo tniachi." The Gemara says, "Yeah, but the Bryce doesn't say that." Did non mosar mesel mesem mosar mesel yoshav. So we're going to first reset the Bryce. Surplus, if the collection were for the general poor and burial needs of the poor, surplus will just simply be reapplied to the next burial. If the collection is for a specific poor, so then it goes obviously to that particular poor, and if there's a surplus, so it goes liyorshin, it goes to those who are going to inherit him. Fine. All we just did right now is reset the Mishnah. Utani Allah. Now we have a brisa. Keitza gabla mesim stam zeh omosar mesel mesim. If I collected it for the general poor, so then the surplus is just going to be reapplied to the next funeral that we need. Gabla mesu zeh omosar mesel yorshav. So, however, if I collect it for this mace, so then the surplus is going to go to his family. Now here in this addendum brisa we just learned together, I collected it for the mace, meaning he's dead already. So, if you subscribe to Abai's viewpoint, this is now in the category of hazmana, and I can't take now any surplus money and just simply hand it over to the children. That surplus money was designated for burial. I can't hand it to the children. So, once again, this addendum brisa clearly is going against Abai. Well, Tamechem Sefer the Gemara says, okay, but let's go on to the second part of the brisa. Rabbi Meir Omer lo yigav ehemach yavo aliyahu. Rabbi Nasan Omer yasen edimus al kivro ozil lifnei mitaso. There are two other opinions in terms of what to be done with the surplus. Rabbi Meir says, you know what you do with the surplus? Nothing. Meaning, don't just leave it in suspension. Put it in some sort of escrow and let it sit there. Eliyahu Navi will come. And he'll tell us what to do with that money, but that money is in the state of Suffolk for reasons which we're going to explain in just a moment. And according to Rabbi Nassan, you know what you do with that surplus money? Spruce up the burial, right? Get a nicer tombstone. Put some wine in order to make the area a little more pleasant smelling. Spruce it up. Take the money, extra money, and just simply apply it to this particular burial. So, what do we see over here? Now, in these second, in these latter opinions, both of Reb Meir and especially of that of Reb Nosson, you see that once the money was designated for the mace, clearly it has to be applied to the mace. This is now going to be imperfect support with Abaye. So now what? Where are we right now in this Braisa, in its completion, both the opinion of the Tanakhama and Rebbe Meir and Rebbe Nosson? So they seem to be at odds at exactly what we're debating, whether or not a designation of something gives it status, to which the Gemara now explains, not necessarily. Ela bai matar satame v'rava matar satame. So the Amoraim say that each Amara is going to look at the Braisa and explain it based on their positions. Abai matar satame. So Abai says, here's how I'm going to look at the entirety of the Braisa. Now remember, Abai says, Asmana Milsa. Designation is considered significant. Dekule ama Asmana Milsahi. Everyone's of the opinion that Asmana is considered significant. Tanakama Safa de Chazile Tafis, Alo Chazile Lo Tafis. Now according to the Tanakama, look, yes, designation is significant. But here's what we're allowed to do according to the Tanakama. You know what's designated? Only that which we need. That which is surplus obviously was never needed. Now, I understand the person who was giving, he doesn't know whether he is in the, whether he's giving to the base or whether it, what he's giving is surplus. But from the Gabbai standpoint, in other words, the assumption that he's making is, at least according to the Tanakhama, the assumption he's making is that, look, whatever is needed for the mace, that's going to be towards the mace. And whatever is not needed is not going to be used for the mace, but it's just simply going to be applied towards the family. That is the opinion of, that's the opinion of the Tanakhama. The, and Reb Meir, Misafke lai tafis ilo tafis, okoch lo yiga behem ashiyavo aliyo. And as far as Reb Meir is concerned, he's in a state of suffix. He doesn't know whether or not the surplus is simply going to be applied towards the children, or maybe no. Maybe the surplus was really intended for the mace himself, which means now that according to Reb Meir, I don't know what to do with that money. Therefore, leave it in suspended perpetuity. Rabbi Nosson, pshitale davade tafis silka chasadim atal kivro. And Rabbi Nosson says all money collected is towards the mace, therefore all money that's collected should be applied to the mace. What about the fact that there's surplus? So just simply use the surplus to make the make the funeral nicer. Make the kever nicer. That is all Abai's understanding of the Braisa. Now we get to Rava. Rava mitar satami l'kulei amaz man alav milsehi. Again, Rava's starting point is that designation by itself is not significant and does not give something status. Tana kama sava ki bazulei achulei macholei zulusei gabi yorshin. Now, over here, the way Rava is going to explain the Braisa is basically a question of mechila. Meaning, look, obviously it is unfortunate and embarrassing. I understand the person's dead, but if we could just project a little bit of how we would feel. It is embarrassing that a collection needs to be made for the individual, that he can't afford his own funeral, his family cannot afford his own funeral, and a collection needs to be made for him. So it's obviously embarrassing. But considering that it's embarrassing, would he be mochel on any surplus that it should go to his children? Or no, maybe he would not be mochel, and considering the fact that there has to be a collection made for his funeral, maybe all that money should be applied to the funeral. So what now the Tanaim are arguing about is, What would he have said had he known about the surplus? I understand this is a projection, but that's exactly what the Tanaim are arguing about. According to the Tanakhama, Mechila, we are going to assume that whatever he needs for this funeral, so apply to the funeral. Whatever's extra, whatever surplus, give to the kids. Rameir says, I don't know. And when I say I don't know, it means I could literally see both sides, and therefore leave the surplus in a state of perpetuity. And Rabbi Nosson pshitale de la machel kachasidim asal kivro ozil lifnei mitaso. And according to Rabbi Nosson, no, don't give any of the money to the children. In other words, now that the collection was made for his funeral, so all the money should be applied to the funeral. None of the money should be sent over to the kids. He's not going to be mochel on that money. Again, he's dead, but we're projecting that he wouldn't be mochel on any of that money, and all that money should be applied towards the funeral. But the hazmana by itself is not the issue. The issue is mechila. Okay, that takes us through the next case. So once again, machlokes Abai and Rava, whether hazmana is milsa or lav milsa. Abai says hazmana is significant. Designation by itself is significant. Rava says hazmana is lav milsa. We have covered now a number of different mishnayos and braisas that seem to indicate one way or another, and the Gemara has so far defended both Abai and Rava in all of these cases. Tashma, we're now on the last line of Mem Chesem and Aleph. Hayu Avi V'Ima Mizakim Bo Kelim. So parents lose their child, and they are understandably terribly emotional, and they're throwing clothing on top of the coffin. And but they're doing so out of total anguish and out of total emotion. And now we know the halach is as follows, like we've been discussing for the balance of yesterday and today. And that is that anything that is like tachrichin and the aron has the status of the mace, which becomes asur ba'ana. So what about all those clothing that are being heaped on top of the child? Are they gonna have the status of tashmishi mace? Are they all gonna be asur ba'ana? Says the Braisa, no. Mitzvah al ha'acherim lahatzilan. So people that are attending the funeral over there, they should save the clothing. Meaning all that clothing should not be buried together with the child. Now, obviously, it's going to be a little bit tricky, a little bit touchy in terms of, you know, the parents are throwing clothing on top of the bier, and other people are simply taking it off. In other words, there's going to be a little bit of finesse needed over here. But as far as we're concerned, in terms of seeing the Braisa, what do you see over here? They're trying to designate the clothing towards the mace. And the Braisa says very clearly, well, it's just let other people pick it off. So you see how Zmana is not significant. This seems to be an excellent support for Rava, and this seems to be against Abaye. So the Gemara says, in defense of Abaye, top of Memches Amud Beis, Hasamishum Marurayu. So the Gemara says, no, that's not considered designation. That's strictly emotional. In other words, the parents are throwing it on, not because they're really thinking to themselves, we're designating this toward the mace. They're just being emotional. And again, it's understandable. But they're just being emotional. So don't call that hazmana. So the Gemara says, well, what about the next part of the Braisa, which is the opinion of Rishon ben Gamliel, who says that if any of the clothing actually touches the body itself, so those clothing you cannot take. In other words, so yes, you should be saving the clothing, but according to Rishon ben Gamliel, once it touches the body, you cannot take the clothing. So why not? Meaning, if hazmana is not an issue, if this is strictly an emotional reaction of the parents, so just take all the clothing. That is not actual tachrichin. So the Gemara says, and again, in defense of Abaye, Targuma Ula b'mita nikberes imo demechafi b'tachrichin ames. Now, the problem is as follows. Meaning, yes, strictly speaking, any clothing that's not tachrichin can be just simply plucked off the body of the mace. Over here, however, once the clothing actually touches the mace itself, Exera de Rabbanan was instituted, according to Rishon ben Gamliel, that this may be confused with the Tachrich, meaning if a casual observer is going to see that we're taking the clothing away from the child that is actually in contact with the child, so one may erroneously think, well, I could take the Tachrich as well. So as they get there, as a fence, so that people realize people won't mistakenly take away clothing that's actually connected to the body, that's actually wrapped around the body. So therefore, once any clothing comes into contact with the body, you cannot take that clothing away. Okay, Tashma. Once again, another Braisa, another proof offered in terms of whether Hazmana is Milsa or Lav Milsa. The Gemara brings in another Braisa. Kisha Aso Lanich Bo Tfilin. If I have, again, a Tfilin bag, also, I can't put money in it. Hiniach bo tefillin, yaniach bo maos. If, however, I put tefillin in the bag without designation, so it doesn't have status. Remember, we already made this point yesterday. We're making it again.
The stuff itself is not designated.
Correct. Correct. We made this point yesterday. We're making it now again. According to Rava and according to Rav Chista, so if the act by itself is not enough, you need both. You need designation and you need an action. So Ema, now this Braisa once again seemingly is going just like Rava. So Ema asov aniach bo tefillin, asol aniach bo maos. I'm sorry, I take that back. In other words, the Braisa says designation by itself is significant. Sorry, this Braisa is supporting Abaye, not Rava. Ema, the Gemara says, now here's how we'll read the Braisa according to Rava. Asau v'hiniach bo tefillin. The way to read the Braisa, the way I incorrectly originally presented it, but now the Gemara is saying this is the correct way to understand the Braisa. And that is that the tefillin bag was designated and it was used. That's the correct way to read the Braisa, and then that would be a support of Rava. Tashma, we're almost done. Amar lo'uman asali tikshel sefer anar tikshel tefillin. So I go over to a craftsman, I said, I'd like a bag for either Sefer Torah or for tefillin, Achal nishamish b'hem kodesh, Motel nishamish b'hem chol. Prior to usage, you're allowed to use it for mundane activities. Nishamish b'hem kodesh, also nishamish b'hem chol. But once I use it, so now it has the status of tashmishi kedusha, and I can't use it for mundane activities. There is simply no way out of this brisa. Okay, this brisa is crystal clear. In order for the nartik, in order for the bag to have status of tashmisha kedusha, you need two factors. You need designation, you need usage. This brisa is crystal clear. We have a brisa concretely going like Rava, Tanaihi. At this point in time, the Gemara now has to concede that we do have a brisa clearly in the camp of Rava. And in terms of defending Abaye, we'll just simply say, we won't simply say, the Gemara is going to simply say that this is actually an antiquated machlokas, and the Tanaim are arguing over this very same issue. Tanaim, the Tanya. Gemara quotes the following brisa. Tzipan zavoshe, talem aleim orshel be'ema tamei psulos. Tfilin, that were had a gold plating on top of the tefillin, no good. Tefillin have to be black. Halacha Moshe Misinai, Rambam, the beginning of Hilchos Tefillin, goes over a number of halachas Moshe Misinai regarding tefillin. Tefillin have to be black. So even though the gold plating looks beautiful, no good to apostles the tefillin. Or let's say the hide that's used is coming from a non-kosher animal. Also, makes the tefillin puzzle. So, and that actually is learned out through a drasha. Okay, not halacha Moshe Misinai, but either way. These are deal breakers when it comes to tefillin. Or behemoth taharus ksheres. If you use a hide of a kosher animal, it's kosher. Afa pi shelo ivdan lishma. And even though the hide itself was not prepared specifically for the tefillin, but as long as the hide is coming from a kosher animal, so, and then after the animal was shechter, and after the hide was prepared for whatever, you can now take the hide and use it for tefillin. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer af or behemot Torah psulos ad sheivdu lishman, and according to Shimon ben Gamliel, even a hide of a kosher animal is only going to be kosher for tefillin if it was tanned and prepared specifically for the purposes of tefillin. And so the Gemara assumes that what they're arguing about is within the machlokes of Abaye and Rava. Now here, admittedly, I'm going to bypass a somewhat lengthier but really important discussion. Now, who's holding like Abaye and who's holding like Rava? It's really not clear. Meaning, clearly they're arguing about whether or not the hide of the animal needs to be tanned for, specifically for tefillin. Shimon ben Gamliel says it does, and the Tanakhama says it does not. So who holds like Abaye and who holds like Rava? So the Gemara does not connect the dots. And that obviously leaves an opening for the Rishonim to give their opinions in terms of who holds like what. It happens to be that on this issue, Rashi goes one way, and Tosfos right here on the daf goes another way. So, I'm assigning homework. So, you're gonna look at Rashi in terms of how he connects the dots between the Tanakhama, Shimon Gamliel, and Abaye and Rava. You're gonna see Tosfos how he connects a dot. Obviously, there's only two options over here in terms of how to connect. You're gonna see Tosfos. Tosfos goes in the other direction, and so and it's the top Tosfos over here. So Rashi and Tosfos is what I'm leaving for homework. Sorry. I have a lot of Gemara to cover. Amle Ravina L'Rava Mi'ika Duchle D'Ramu Be'Meis V'Argi Begela Meis. Gemara says, you know, this whole discussion has been very strange. Meaning, the Gemara is winding down in the discussion. And the Gemara is now pointing out, the discussion here is really strange. Because, what are we talking about? We're talking about after somebody died, and preparing the Tachrichin after the person died. In other words, remember, because if you're preparing the Tachrichin before the person died, that is too early. Meaning even Abaye will tell you that's not hazmana, because it's a preparatory to a preparatory stage. And even Abaye will tell you that that's not significant. So we're talking only, the entire discussion now here, at least from the very beginning, is all really dealing with preparing the tachrichin after the person died. The Gemara says that's not normal. So amalei in kigon she shichve darpanya. So the Gemara says It's not totally out of the realm of possibility. Gemara says that people in Harpanya who die, they're so poor, they couldn't afford the tachrichin, and they're literally patchworking the tachrichin after the person died because they were so poor. That's how Rashi describes the Gemara. Okay. Darsh Merimah Hilchza Kavasa de Abaye. Merimah gets up in public and he tells everyone the halacha here is like Abaye, the Hazmana Milsa. Rabban Rami Hilchza Kavasa de Rava. However, he is a lone position on this matter. The Chachamim side with Rava, Vilchza Kavasi de Rava, and the Gemara here says that the Halacha falls like Rava. We, by the way, the learners of Gemara, we already knew that, because the Gemara elsewhere, actually right here in Sanhedrin, back in the third parak, if you remember, told us that the Halacha falls like Rava, with six exceptions, and they are the Al-Kagam, the six Machloks and Mishas, represented by the letters Yud Ayin Lamed Kuf Gimel Mem. This is not one of them. So we already knew that the halacha is not going like Abaye. But, you know, the Gemara is anyway telling us that the halacha falls like Rava. Tanu Rabbanan. Okay. That is the end of the Gemara's discussion of Hazmana Milsa, Lav Milsa. Again, Machlokas Abaye and Rava. Again, the Gemara here very definitively concludes that the halacha follows like Rava, Hazmana, Lav Milsa. That designation of an item by itself does not give it status. It is designation and usage. And as we learned also in the course of this discussion, according to Rava, and as amplified by Rav Chista, it has to be both. It has to be both a designation and it has to be usage. Tanu Rabbanan.
You need designation according to, what if you don't have designation, you just use it?
Not enough. Insufficient. The Gemara said very clearly. That's insufficient. According to Rava and according to Rav Chista, usage by itself does not create designation. Right. Ben also was bothered by that, meaning, you know, if you're using it, isn't that a de facto designation? I hear the point. The Gemara clearly rejects that point. Okay.
You then pick it out and then use it for something else.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. Tanu Rabbanan. Right in the middle of Mem Ches Amud Beis. We are moving from here until the end of the parak. Now we're going to be moving discussions to the following topic of discussion. Okay. Just as a quick intro. I said this a number of times. It's good to be the king. Second parak of Sanhedrin, which we did not so long ago, but a month ago. So we described how good it is to be the king. Obviously, the king, you know, with responsibility, with power comes a lot of responsibility. But king has power and power to even take somebody's life. Meaning, if somebody rebels against the king has within his power to put the person to death. Now, the Gemara is not perfectly clear. Does the king have to work within the judicial process? Does he need some sort of court? Or can the king do it strictly on his own? The Gemara is not absolutely clear about that. That's open for a discussion, open for a debate. But if you're Morid B'melech, if you rebel against the directive of the king, so the king has the right to kill you. And now, here comes part two of this discussion, and that is, once you are Morid B'melech, and once the king kills you, so now, who gets your possessions? There will be an opinion, which the Gemara now is going to record, that it's going to go to the king. Meaning, if the king kills you because you are a Morid B'malchus, so now, he not only killed you, but he also has the right to take all your possessions. It does not go to your Yerushim. Okay. Now, I'll say to you, it's based on Psukim. Okay. But the Psukim are not super clear about this, and the Gemara is going to be debating this very issue. Tanu Rabbanan. So we start with a Braisa. It's a Tosefta. Haruge Malchus Nechsem Lamelach. So according to the Tanakhama, if you're a Haruge Malchus, killed by the king, for being a Morid B'Malchus, so your possessions go to the king. Haruge Beis Din Nechsem L'Yorshim. However, if you're killed by Beis Din, so the Nechasim go to the Yorshim. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Af Haruge Malchus Nechsem L'Yorshim. Now Rabbi Yehuda says that even if you're killed by the king, your Nechasim are not repossessed by the king, but rather it goes to your Yorshim. So, here we have now a simple debate. I mean, simple. Not the best adjective. But we have a debate now between the Tanakhama and Rav Yehuda. If you're killed by Sanhedrin, there is no debate. In other words, Sanhedrin kills you lawfully, meaning obviously, that's the only way Sanhedrin's killing you, based on the fact that you violated a capital crime and going through the due process based and killed you, your possessions will go to your next of kin. That's clear. But what is not clear, what is open for debate now in the Gemara is, what if the king kills you because you're a Morid B'Malchus? Who gets your possessions? Tanakhama says the king. Rav Yehuda says your family. And now the Gemara is going to explain where these two positions are coming from. Amar the Rav Yehuda v'lo kfar nemar hinei bekerem navos asher yara sham l'rishto. So our first stop, we're gonna take a serious tour of Tanakh today, a very serious tour of Tanakh. And I'm going to pretend, and hopefully I will do a good job, like I know Tanakh. Okay, so bear with me as, you know, I reach back far into my childhood memories to extract all the necessary information so that the Gemara will become very clear. Our first stop today is going to be Achav and Navos. Achav was one of Machi Yisrael. He had a person living next to him by the name of Navos. He wanted the vineyard of that person living next to him. So what he, Achav, did together with his wife, Izebel, is that they trumped up charges against Navos, that he was both he was Berech Hashem, he blasphemed, and also he cursed the king as well. And for those trumped up charges, which they hired witnesses in order to trump up those charges, this is not the first time we're going over this episode in Sanhedrin. We did this once before, earlier in the Masechta. So because of the charges that they trumped up, so Navos now was killed, and then they assumed the vineyard of Navos. That's how they got to the vineyard of Navos. If you look at the pasuk that we just read and look at it carefully, it says, Yarasham Lirishto. They went there and he was Yorishit. Now the language obviously of the Navi is very precise. He inherited it. So it's pretty clear that the Navi's choosing that language to teach us the halacha that when a king kills somebody, so they're Yorish. Now, admittedly, it is a strange proof because the Achav in this particular case killed him illegally. In other words, by hiring witnesses to do so. So I admit it is a strange source because he was a Morid B'melech, but only based on lies and trumped up charges. I know that part's strange, but the Navi is using the word Yoresh, and that gives us a clue to the halacha that the king is going
to
inherit.
We always consider Ahab to be such an evil king. Are we assuming that he's following halacha?
No, it's just that the language that the Navi is using to make this point, meaning the Navi did not have to say the word Lirishto. I'm openly admitting it is a strange source. But the language that's used is Lirishto, and that's where the Gemara is learning from. So Amalehem ben Achi Aviv Haya, verily Yersho Haya. So the Gemara, Rav Yehuda says now, in defense of his own position is, no. The reason why the Navi over there uses the word Yerusha is because, and here comes a curveball, right? Maybe you didn't see this one coming. Achav and Navos were actually first cousins. Paternal first cousins. This is what Rav Yehuda says in his defense, and he's going to make this case. And therefore, the word Yerusha is used over there because they're actually family. They're mishpacha. It's not because he's the king, and the king inherits someone who's married by Malchus, but because they're actually family. So to which Rav Yehuda says back to, sorry, the Chachamim say back to Rav Yehuda, what do you mean? He's inheriting him because he's family. Navos had other family members. In fact, Navos had children. And so if this was a function of Yerusha, his children, of course, comes before a cousin. So Amalem also Vesbanav Harag, Shenemar, Im Lo Esdemei Navos Vesdemei Banav Reisi. To which the counter argument is, when Achav killed Navos, not only did Achav kill Navos, but he killed also the children as well. And the Navi seems to indicate that. Meaning, you read the Pesukim in Malachim, it says, Demei Navos, Demei Banav. So in other words, so now that he killed both Navos and his children, so then there's no one who is closer in relationship than the king himself, who was the first cousin. V'rabanan, now the Chachamim are looking at the same Pasuk, but the Chachamim will simply say, no, you're not understanding the Pasuk correctly. Ha'u banim ha'ru'uyim atzeis mimenu. No, that pasuk is not describing Achav actually killing the sons of Navos. The pasuk, when it says demei, simply means you kill Navos and his potential to produce future children. Right? Remember, we had a very similar drasha recently when it comes to Cain and Hevel. Right? Demei Achim Tzoakim Alai. Right? The blood of your brother, meaning all the potential children that your brother could have had. So here, that's what the pasuk means, and so. Again, according to the Chachamim, there were people who could have inherited the vineyard, but according to the Chachamim, because Achav killed Navos as a Morid B'melech, using his Melech status to kill him, so therefore that's why he gets the vineyard. So the Gemara says, look, I understand the, if you, let me start that sentence again. If you maintain the position that the king inherits somebody he kills, because the person was a Morid B'melech, so I understand the charges. There were actually two charges that Achav levied against Navos. The witnesses who were hired by Achav levied against Navos. One is that he was a blasphemer. Two is that he cursed the king as well. Why were there two charges? Because if it was just blasphemy, so then that's Sanhedrin. But now that he also added and he cursed the king, that's Morid B'malchus. And now he's able to repossess his property. Elamanda amar nechsem liyarshim lamali umelech. So the Gemara says, but you, Rav Yehuda, who are of the opinion that if the kings kill somebody, the property is going to go to the yarshim, so then, quite frankly, one charge would be sufficient. And just simply saying that he's a blasphemer would be enough, because it's going to go to the Yorish. And again, according to Rav Yehuda, we assume that Achav happens to be the next of kin. So, Ula Tamech, Elokim Lamali. So the Gemara says, okay, but if you're telling me that there are two charges, there's one too many. So the Gemara says, so why not just simply say that he was Mar B'Malchus? Meaning, why do you think that Achav had a double charge against Navos? So, Ela Lafushe Rizcha, Achanam Lafushe Rizcha. Basically, so that either the Sanhedrin or the people would be super upset with Navos, because now, according to these charges, not only did he curse God, but he cursed the king as well. So with this double trumped-up charge, so now Sanhedrin is going to really go after Navos in order to kill him. And so basically, a simple way to explain why it's a double charge is just simply to get the either the Sanhedrin or the people to be really against Navos and really interested in killing him. Okay, Adkan. So far, where are we at right now in the Gemara? A king kills somebody, so does he get the possessions of the person he killed? Chachamim say yes, Rav Yehuda says no. And now we turn our attention to another place in Tanakh where this machlokas seems to come up. And that is the following. We are in An Memches Amud Beis, second wide line of the Amud Bishlama. So here we go. We are now going to get a tour de force of Shmuel Beis in the beginning of Malachim Aleph. Okay, so please stay with me. I'm going to go over this quickly and hopefully accurately. Okay, Yoav is running because before David HaMelech dies, he tells his son Shlomo, listen, you're a smart man, you'll know exactly what to do with Yoav. So, David dies, Shlomo HaMelech, who is a smart man, knows exactly what to do with Yoav, and so now he sends Benayahu in order to fetch Yoav so that Shlomo can kill Yoav, for reasons which the Gemara is going to explain in just a moment. Now, if we all went through Shmuel Beis right now, time does not permit, but if we went through Shmuel Beis right now, we would all know why as well. So, Yoav knows that he's about to see his demise, so Yoav runs into the base of Mikdash and literally holds on to the corners of the Mizbeach, the Karnos of Mizbeach, in order to get sanctuary and what he believes is going to be some sort of respite from what is going to be his demise. Uksiv, Vayomer lo, kipo amos. Now Yoav says to Benayahu, I'm dying right here. Now, Rashi points out, how does all of this make sense? So Rashi points out like this. Look, if let's say Shlomo kills Yoav. So who's going to get his possessions? So if you hold like the Chachamim, the answer is very clear. Shlomo. Meaning that he's charging Yoav being a Mord B'Malchus, and if the Melech gets to kill him, so the Melech gets his possessions. Yoav, knowing he's going to die, basically says like this to Benayahu. Look, I know I'm going to die, but I'm not going to be tried by the Melech, I'm going to be tried by the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin will kill me. And if the Sanhedrin kills me, so then my possessions are going to go to my children. So, basically, when Yoav says, I'm dying here, what he really is saying is, right, I'm in the Beis HaMikdash right now. You see that room right over there? Points to the Lishkas HaGazis, the Sanhedrin, that's who's going to try me. You're not going to try me, that's who's going to try me. So if you subscribe to the Chachamim's viewpoint, so then you understand this dialogue, this very short dialogue. Elaman, Darmanichsem Liyoshe, my Nafkalemina. But if you subscribe to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, that regardless of who kills Yoav, whether it's the Sanhedrin or whether it's the king, so his possessions are going to go to his children. So quite frankly, what difference does it make? Meaning if you subscribe to Rav Yehuda's viewpoint, in either way, the possessions are going to go to the children. So the Gemara says, Amalei l'chaisha. So the Gemara says that, a simple explanation, super simple. Yoav want to live a little bit longer. Meaning, yeah, he was going to die, and yeah, it wasn't going to make a difference whether the king killed him or whether Sanhedrin killed him. The possessions are going to go to his family. And all he simply wanted to do was just live a little bit longer. It's that simple. Okay, and now with that stated, so where do we stand now on the machlokas between the Chacham and Rav Yehuda? It's machlokas. Whether or not, if a person is killed by the king because he was a Mord B'Melech, whether the king gets his possessions or the family gets his possessions. Now, Hedy, just in anticipation of your question, I assume we go like the Chachamim, but, you know, the Hilchas of the Mashiach, meaning when the king comes back, so, you know, this halacha would apply. Hopefully never. In other words, we don't want to think about a Mord B'Melech, but I assume like the halacha is like the Chachamim. But now that we're here, Now the Gemara is going to go on a significant tour de force in terms of explaining what happened with Yoav, why did David HaMelech want Yoav killed, what was Yoav thinking, what was his self-defense, etc., etc., and here we go. As Rashi points out over here, Benayahu is reporting back to Shlomo HaMelech a dialogue that does not take place in the Navi itself, because the Navi is very terse, but the Navi seems to indicate, when I say the Navi, I mean the Pesukim in the Navi. The Navi seems to indicate that there was a little bit more to the dialogue than just what we have in the Pesukim. Amar le zilem ale tarti lo tavid b'hai gavra ikatot le kabol itusai delataya avucha v'ilo shavke delay kabol itusai delatech avucha. And basically, this was the message that Yoav sent back with Benayahu to Shlomo HaMelech, and it goes like this. Look, I was cursed by your father. And we're actually going to go over the curse in just a moment. I was cursed by your father. And I have a curse now for me and my family for all future generations. So basically, he said to Shlomo HaMelech, you're going to pick your poison. Here's how it's going to be. Either you're not going to kill me, and you're going to let me be, and I will live for the rest of my life with the curse of your father. However, if you kill me, so then the curse is going to not only not apply to me, because the curse was left for me, but only if I die, quote unquote, naturally. But on top of that, because you killed me, you're going to accept the curse and you're going to assume the curse that your father gave me. And I assume, well, the Gemara doesn't spell this point out, but I assume the idea over here is that, look, the curse is only there for Yoav if nothing else were to happen to Yoav. But if Yoav is killed by Shlomo, which as we'll see in just a moment he was, so now the curse was bechinam. Now Yoav didn't need to be cursed as he was killed by Shlomo HaMelech, right, as per the instructions of David. And so now the curse doesn't just simply go away, it doesn't dissipate, but rather now the curse is going to bounce on Shlomo. So what Yoav is saying to Shlomo HaMelech is, you're going to have to choose. Let me live with the curses, or kill me, but then assume the curse. That's a fair question. I don't know. I'm with you. I don't know. So we know the conclusion. The Navi spells it out. Shlomo HaMelech kills Yoav. So now, as Yoav predicted correctly, all those curses that David HaMelech gave Yoav now is going to apply to David HaMelech's own family. Bounce. It's a boomerang. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav Kol Klal Shekilo David is Yoav Niskayma Bezor Shel David. It all applied to David HaMelech. Ali Karez me base Yoav, and now we're going back to Shmuel Beis, the beginning of Shmuel Beis, third parak, and we're looking back at the curse that David HaMelech gives Yoav. Parenthetically, David HaMelech curses Yoav because he thinks that Yoav is supportive of the rebellion. So the curse that he gave him was Ali Karez me base Yoav Zav Mitzora Machzik Bepelach Venofa Becher VeChaser Lechem. So a number of different curses. We're going to go through each one individually. So number one, he says that from the family of Yoav is going to come out a Zav. Now remember, all these curses now are bouncing back to David HaMelech. So we're looking now at future kings of Malchi Yehuda, descendants of David, who are all going to have this curse. Number one, from David HaMelech there was a Zav. And that is, the Gemara says, Rechavam, Dechziv HaMelech Rechavam, Hita Mitzlalos B'mer Kavalanus Yerushalayim. So Rechavam goes on the Merkava. Now that's a chariot. But we also know that Merkava is linguistically connected with a Zav. The Gemara here makes a connection. Ksiv, v'chol ha-merkav asher yikav alav azav, gitma. So you see that the Merkav is really code for a Zav, meaning that Rechavam was inflicted with being a Zav. Mitzora. Me'uziyahu. So a later king of Malchi Yehuda was Uziyahu, and he suffered from Tzaraz. Dechziv. So Uziyahu offered Ketores. Now, Uziyahu clearly was not a Kohen. He was from the family of Yehuda. That's pretty obvious. And he was offering Ketores. You can't do that if you're not a Kohen. He did. And the moment that he tried to offer Ketores in the base of Mikdash, so he broke out in Tzaraz. Next, Machzik Bepelech, walking on a cane, Me'asa. So that's a later king of from Malchi Yehuda, and that is Asa. Dechsiv Rak Le'isik Naso Chalas Raglav. So as Asa was getting older, so he needed a cane to walk. He could not walk on his own feet. So he had something which we probably will call gout. So the Gemara, the Amoraim asked Rav Nachman, could you describe what gout basically feels like? So it's like needles into raw flesh. That's what gout feels like. How did Rav Nachman know that? One suggestion of the Gemara is that he actually suffered from gout. Or he had a tradition from his Rebbe. Or we have a general principle that when you're a tzaddik, and so you know things, right? Sod Hashem l'riav, Hashem's secrets are revealed to those who fear Him. Ubriso lahodiam nofal becherev. And again, continuing now in the curses that David HaMelech levied against Yoav, which now are bouncing back to the family of David HaMelech. So, going to fall by the sword. Yoshiyahu dichsiv, v'yor l'melech Yoshiyahu, the Yoshiyahu was asked by Paro if... Paro meaning Paro at the time of Yoshiyahu Melech, obviously a later Paro. This is towards the end of Bais Rishon. He asked Paro asked, "Can I get passage through Israel in order so that I can attack Ashur?" And Yoshiyahu said no. And the Navi says to Yoshiyahu, "Don't say no, say yes." But Yoshiyahu felt that he would that his tzitzkos would protect him. Did not. And va'amar Rav Yehuda Amarav Shasa kol gufo kigavra. That Yoshiyahu was speared time and again through his body, and it looked like a sieve. V'chaser lachem, and the last klala that David gives Yoav, which now bounces back to the family of David, is Yechaniah. Yechaniah, one of the last kings of Malchi Yehuda during Bais Rishon. So dichsiv v'aruchaso, aruchas tamid ninalo. That Yechaniah was sent into exile, taken into exile by Nebuchadnezzar, and while in prison by Nebuchadnezzar, so he was given a daily ration. But basically, he had no bread to eat, and he was reliant on Nebuchadnezzar to feed him. Amar Rav Yehuda Amarav, Haino Darmi Inshi, and the Gemara says, a lesson to learn from all this, Tehe Luta, Velo Tehe Lata. On the exchange of a curse, be the one being cursed, do not be the one giving the curse. And the lesson over here is extraordinarily powerful. David HaMelech felt that he was right in cursing Yoav. And perhaps he was. But the problem, of course, is that the curse is powerful. And the curse doesn't just simply vanish or dissipate. And if necessary, the way Rashi describes it, a kilas chinam lashuv al hamakalal. That once the curse becomes a kilas chinam, it doesn't just simply go away, but it boomerangs and bounces back to the one who gives the curse. So do not be on an exchange of the cursing and the being cursed. So be on the side of being cursed, not the one doing the cursing. Okay, Asiyu Eliyahu. We're on the top of Mem Testament Aleph. If you have to go, I totally understand. I'm going to finish. We're behind, so I'm going to finish the Amud over here, and you can, if you need to go, that's fine. And just you can listen later to the recording. Asiyu Eliyahu. So now they bring Yoav in for trial. Meaning, remember, that was Yoav's request. Yoav's request was as he's hanging on to the Kronos. He says, I'm going to be tried here, meaning in front of Sanhedrin. So, okay. So now basically we are at the trial of Yoav. So, Asiyu Eliyahu Daina Amar Le Maitama Kal Katlasi La Avner. Okay, so, charge number one against Yoav. You killed Avner, which is true, he did. And over here now, what's going to be at issue in the trial is justified or not justified. Was Yoav justified in killing Avner? Obviously, Yoav feels that he was justified. And the Sanhedrin is arguing, you were not justified, and let's now go through some of the details. So, my time katlasa l'avner, amalei gol adam da'asel havai. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you why. Because Avner killed my brother. Now, Yoav's brother was Asael, and Avner killed Asael. Avner was the general of Shaul. Asael was together with David's army. And so when David's army and Shaul's army were going against one another, so Avner ends up killing Asael, who's the brother of Yoav. So now, what is Yoav saying in his defense? I am a Goel Hadam, meaning?
It was done with
Nisim. Which way? Okay, I'm with you. We're right now in the trial. So Yoav says, now argue, I'm a Goel Adam. Therefore, I had the right. I was justified in killing Avner, because Avner ended up killing my brother. So the Gemara says, Goel Adam Dasel Havai. Asael Rodef Hava. So the Gemara says, wait 1 second. Avner killed Asael, but it wasn't in battle. It was after the battle. Asael was running after Avner. The Navi describes Asael as being very fleet-footed, super fast. So Avner was not going to be able to outrun Asael. And so Avner turned around and defended himself. Avner killed Asael, but the Sanhedrin is saying, not out of self-defense. So you're not a Goel Hadam, the Sanhedrin is saying to Yoav, because when Avner killed your brother, he did it out of self-defense. So Amar Leh, so Yoav now, sitting in the defense chair, says to the Sanhedrin, I disagree. He says, no. When Avner killed Asael, he didn't have to kill Asael. He could have just simply taken out a limb. And we know the halach is, we're going to see it later in the Masechta, in the 8th Perek, that when you are defending yourself, if you don't have to kill the Rodef, and if you could just stop him by shooting him in the leg, or some other way stopping him, so then disabling him, you don't have the right to kill him. And so what Yoav says in his defense is that no, Avner killed Asael, but Avner didn't have to kill Asael. He could have just simply stopped him. So I don't. Wait 1 second. I don't know. So Amar Lei Lo Yachalei. So the Beis Din says to Yoav, no, that's not true. In other words, that when Avner kills Asael, he had no other means. He had to kill him in order to defend himself. Now, Yoav says, I disagree with you. I do not think that there was no other way to stop him, and I'll prove my point. Because when Avner actually kills Asael, and the Navi describes that that Avner hit Asael in a very specific place. So he hit him in the fifth rib. It's the place where the gallbladder and the liver are situated. So in other words, it's a lethal blow. And Avner did that specifically, which means that he had absolute precision in terms of where he hit Asael. And you're now telling me that he could have hit him. He couldn't have disabled him. For sure he could have disabled him. Look where he hit him, and look at the precision of where he hit him. So if he hit him there, he could have hit him somewhere else in order to disable him. So Yoav is saying that this was not strictly self-defense. If it was self-defense, he could have just stopped him without having to kill him. He killed him anyway. I'm a Goel Hadam. This is Yoav's defense in terms of how he had the right to kill Avner. So, I should have read that. That was the end of the sentence. Okay. In other words, okay, everything I just said is correct. I just should have read one more line. Okay, continuing. Amar Lei, Nezo Avner, my time, Katal Se La Amasa. So now the Sanhedrin said, okay, let's move on to the next topic. Okay, and it seems like from the Gemara that actually Yoav did a good job defending himself in terms of him killing Avner. Okay, so the Gemara says, let's move on to the next topic. And the next topic is Amasa. Amasa, another person that Yoav killed. So Amar Lei Amasa Mori B'Machuzav Adichsiv. So now, as far as Amasa and the death of Amasa, again, it's factual. Meaning Yoav did kill Amasa, and now the Gemara is going to go over the details of what Yoav was thinking in terms of why he killed Amasa and why Yoav felt that he was justified in killing Amasa. The Gemara quotes the Navi. Once again, Shmuel Beis, 20th Perek. Vayomar Melech Amasa Azek Li Es Ishu Udash Shosh Yamim. Now, Amasa did spend a little bit of time following the rebellion against David HaMelech, but then comes back to David HaMelech. Yoav was always suspicious of Amasa in terms of him not being a loyalist to David HaMelech. With that background, David HaMelech then gives instructions for Amasa to put together an army in order to fight for David. Amasa does so, but not in a timely fashion. David HaMelech says, I need an army here in 3 days. And Amasa did not get the army there in 3 days. Yoav already had suspicions about Amasa, and on top of that saw that Amasa was delinquent in getting the army together. So now Yoav is thinking, oh, Morid B'Machus. Amasa is a Morid B'machus, therefore, I have the right to kill Amasa. That's all in Yoav's thought process. Vayelech Amasa la'azik is Yehuda v'yocher. And the Navi actually describes how Amasa, when putting the army together for David HaMelech, actually is delayed in doing so. And so now, Yoav is describing and labeling this as a case of Morid B'machus. So Amalei Amasa achem v'rakim darish. So now the Sanhedrin is going to defend Amasa, and in doing so, basically say to Yoav, you were not justified in killing him, and therefore, once again, this puts you as a murderer. So, why was Amasa delinquent in putting the army together for David HaMelech? So the Gemara now explains because. And the Gemara here gives us more details. Details that we don't see in the Navi. Ashkechino de pasuk le b'mesechta. So now, Amasa goes to the camp and is ready to amass them as a troop for David HaMelech, and they're starting a new Masechta. Okay? In other words, they're learning. So, Amar, Ksiv, Kol Isha Asher Yamar Espicha V'lo Ishma Severecha, L'chol Asher Titzaveni Yumas. And he says that anyone who violates the words of the king is subject to death. Meaning, this is the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, and this, in fact, is the source I mentioned at the beginning of this entire discussion. This, in fact, is the source that teaches us that anyone who's a Morid B'melech is subject to the death penalty. It says so in the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua. Fine. But now Amasa is learning up this pasuk in Sefer Yehoshua, but with an addendum, with a proviso. And that is, Yachol Afilu Divrei Torah. What if, however, there is learning involved? Limud HaTorah. So Amasa is of the opinion, based on the Pesukim in Yehoshua, that if the troop is learning Torah, so then, again, I'm sure this is not as simple as I'm presenting it, but for our purposes right now, I'm going to keep it simple. If there's Limud HaTorah involved, so then there is an allowance for a delay in the instructions that were given. So Talmud Lama, Rak, Chazak ve'ematz. The Pesukim in Yehoshua says, Rak, Chazak ve'ematz. And we know, B'derech HaDrush, when you see the word Rak, it's a limitation. And so when Amasa is reading this pasuk in Yehoshua, his understanding is that, yes, you follow the letter of the law, letter of the king. Let me say that again. Yes, you follow the instructions of the king to a T, but if there's Limud HaTorah that's involved, so you can, so to say, you can extend a little bit, delay a little bit the instructions of the king. So Elahu gavra morid b'malchus avadichsiv. Fine. So, because the troop were learning, started a new Masechta at that point in time, so Amasa felt justified in not bringing the army over to the king immediately, or I should say better, within the 3 days that David instructed, but Amasa was in fact justified in delaying bringing the troops over. So once again, now in the trial, so Yoav is accused of killing Amasa, which he did. Yoav is now trying to describe Amasa as being a Morid B'malchus, and now the Sanhedrin said he was not. Continuing. Dichsiv, I'm sorry. Ela ha'ugavra Morid B'malchus ava dichsiv. Vashmu ba'a ad Yoav, ki Yoav nata chere Adoniyahu v'achere Avshalom lo nata. Now the Gemara says, fine. So, was he justified in killing Avner? Maybe, maybe not. And again, Yoav feels that he was justified because he was a Goel Adam. Was he justified in killing Amasa, Yoav killing Amasa? Again, maybe, maybe not. Meaning, he felt that Amasa was a Morid B'malchus and the Sanhedrin felt that he was not. Now the Sanhedrin turns to Yoav and says, okay, Yoav, you killed two people, you felt you were justified in both, we feel not. It's honestly, meaning, from the Gemara itself, not clear whose argument was the stronger of the arguments. But on top of all that, the Gemara now is pointing out, the Sanhedrin says to Yoav, but you, Yoav, you know, you're a Morid B'malchus also. Meaning, you are not a super loyalist all the time. And now the Gemara quotes the Pasuk in the beginning of Sefer Malachim. I'm going to reread the Pasuk. V'ashmua ba'ad Yoav ki Yoav nata achari Adoniyah v'achari Avshalom lo nata. Yoav did follow Adoniyah. Meaning that when David HaMelech died, so for a small stint of time, so there was a contest in terms of who was going to become the next king. Now, David clearly chose Shlomo, but after David's death, that was not perfectly clear. And there was a point in time where Adoniyah could have been the next in line. And in fact, Yoav, initially did support Adoniyah. So the Sanhedrin says to Yoav, look, even without the two people that you killed, you supported Adoniyah against Shlomo HaMelech. And Shlomo HaMelech was the one selected by David HaMelech. So in that regard, you're a Mord B'machus. And furthermore, you didn't support Avshalom, meaning this is not the first rebellion. A rebellion of Avshalom took taking place earlier, where Avshalom rebelled against his father, David, and you didn't side with Avshalom. Now, that doesn't sound like an accusation, but if you read the pasuk carefully, it's like kind of like an encoded accusation. You didn't follow Avshalom. Generally speaking, you're going to find, at least I do, that when somebody is, you know, denying having done something, it means that to a certain degree, they did it. So when the Navi says, you didn't follow Avshalom, so the Gemara is now reading carefully, you did a little bit. And the Gemara actually says this, my lo nata, am Rav Yehuda shebikesh lintos v'lo nata. Actually, when Avshalom was rebelling against David, so if you could have gotten into the heart of hearts of Yoav, Yoav would have followed with Avshalom. He didn't, but not because he was a loyalist, simply out of fear. Out of fear of David HaMelech. And the Gemara now spells that out. On my time alone, Atam, Rabbi Lazar, I die in Lichluchios, Shel David, Kayemis. Because David was still strong, meaning David was such a power, such a force, that he didn't follow, he didn't follow Avshalom, but he wanted to. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Chanin, I die in Itzagnine, Shel David, Kayemin. The Gemara gives a similar explanation, just, you know, a slightly different twist, but the same basic point. David HaMelech still had his muscle. Now the Gemara here has an unusual description. Gemara calls it Itzagnine Shel David HaMelech, the astrologers of David HaMelech. It's as we'll see in just a moment. They're not astrologers, but the Amar of Yehuda Marav Arba Meis Yoladim Havu Lola David Kulam Bnei Yifas Torah Havu Omegad Los Blurias Hayu Mahalchem Beroshay Gaius Hayu Vehein Hein Balei Grof from Shel David. This is the second time in the Masechta that we're being introduced to the 400 sons of David HaMelech, who are all under the category of Eishes Yifas Torah, yesterday's Parsha, and these 400 who had non-Jewish mothers, right? I'm saying that in the context of Eishes Yifas Torah. So they were tough. They wore their hair tough. They talked tough. They looked tough. They were tough. And so again, why didn't Yoav side with Avshalom? Look at the 400 kids of David HaMelech. Okay, no, thank you. I won't side with Avshalom. But again, it's the same basic idea. Meaning, he wanted to side with Avshalom, but, you know, for fear, he did not. Okay. Where are we right now? So we are wrapping up the trial of Yoav. Okay. And we all know what the ending is. Meaning, we got the verdict. We're just now in the details, hopefully not lost, but we're in the details of the trial where Yoav killed Avner, Yoav killed Amasa, Yoav sided with Adoniyahu. So for a number of reasons, Yoav was Chayv Misa. Again, the Gemara went through details of why Yoav felt he was justified. Okay. And now, also what in the course of this discussion, what also came into question was Yoav's loyalty to David. And the Gemara actually is challenging his loyalty to David. And according to some Amorim that we just saw, he was not actually, in his heart of hearts, totally loyal to David HaMelech. Upligid Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana. But the Gemara says, but on this last point that we just went over, not agreement. Some Amoraim are of the opinion that Yoav was a perfect loyalist to David HaMelech, and he never wavered in his loyalty to David HaMelech. I will plead to Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, the Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Yomali David lo asa Yoav Muhammad, the Yomali Yoav lo asa David b'Torah. David and Yoav had a symbiotic and harmonious relationship in which Yoav fought the battles, David took care of the Torah, and they leaned on each other. And because they were working in concert to one another, so Yoav was able to fight the battles, and David was able to learn Torah and judge the people. Dichsiv, vayi David osa mishpat tzaka l'cholam, v'yoav ben Tzruya al hatzava. The pasuk in the beginning of Shmuel Beis, towards the beginning of Shmuel Beis, says that David was the king and Yoav was the general. Like as if like they were working in concert together. And according to this Amara, Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, that's exactly the point. So, Matam David asa mishpat atzaka l'chol amo, mishum de Yoav al atzava, umatam Yoav al atzava, mishum de David asa mishpat atzaka l'chol amo. Meaning that they were mutually benefiting one another. Yoav was fighting the army, freeing up David's time for learning and judging. David was learning and judging, freeing up Yoav's time to dedicate himself to fighting the battle. Okay, and according to this according to this Amora, there was never any unfaithfulness on the part of Yoav towards David HaMelech. Okay. As long as we're here and we're finishing up the parak right now, so the Gemara, wow. It's late in the day. As long as we're here, we're finishing up the perek right now. So we are now continuing in learning up a couple more psukim regarding Yoav. So, Yoav leaves David, and he sends emissaries to Avner, and Vayeshiva Osomi Bor Asira, taking him from Bor Asira. Gemara goes on to explain. My Bor Asira, Amar Abba Abba Barkana Bor Vesira Garmalola Avner Sheyareg. Avner was killed because of Bor and Sira. Okay, I'll say this succinctly, and I'm not going to read the Rashi inside again. More to do for tonight. But basically like this. There were a number of occasions where David and Shaul were at each other. And to be slightly more accurate, Shaul was after David, meaning that Shaul wanted to kill David. And David on a number of occasions tried to create peace between him and Shaul. And there were two occasions specifically where David had an opportunity to kill Shaul and didn't do so. And made it clear that an opportunity to kill David, to kill Shaul and did not do so. And there were two occasions in the Navi. The Gemara here just makes allusions to them. Rashi goes to them with more specifics. For our purposes right now, what we need to know, just to understand the Gemara, is that on both occasions where David sent down a message to Shaul, I could have killed you and I did not. And on both occasions, Avner then whispered in Shaul's ear, and Avner said to Shaul, he really couldn't have killed you. Meaning, it's not true. And Avner kept the animosity going between Shaul and David. And as a result of that, Avner deserved to die. So basically what the Gemara is doing is just going back now to explain. In other words, it's not just that Yoav killed Avner and Avner didn't deserve it. No, Avner did deserve it for his own actions. The Gemara now goes over the psukim where Yoav actually kills Avner. And he says he brings him to the shaar to speak about the Sheli. Now, what is all this? I'm Rav Yochanan Shadana Din Sanhedrin. So what he did is he judged him like a Sanhedrin would judge him. I'm Rale Maitama Katatel Asael. So now Yoav says to Avner, you killed Asael, why'd you kill Asael? And so this dialogue we already know because in the trial of Yoav we went over this already. But now this is Yoav actually asking Avner point blank, you know, you killed Asael, why'd you do that? So Asael Rodifaya. So he says, what do you mean? I killed him because he was a rodif. So he says, what do you mean? You didn't have to kill him. You could have disabled him. So Avner says, what do you mean? I couldn't have disabled him. So I'm sorry. And again, Yoav gets the last word over here. No, you could have disabled him. You hit him in the fifth rib. You knew exactly where you were aiming for. You could have just as well knocked out a leg. In other words, you could have disabled him. You didn't. You killed him unjustly. This is what Yoav accuses Avner. And again, this same discussion. This is just a direct confrontation between Yoav and Avner. And finally, Ladaber Yitob Sheli. Now, exactly how did Yoav kill Avner? So he asked him a question in halacha. And the Gemara explains which halacha? Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav al iske shalu. Rashi explains over here, he asked him about the shoe. Rashi describes over here in the Gemara that what Yoav asked Avner is, in the event that you have a chalitza that needs to be done, where generally speaking, the woman has to take the shoe off the foot of the man, but let's say she doesn't have hands, what is she supposed to do? So Avner then demonstrates to answer the question of Yoav, she'll take it off with her teeth. And he bends down to demonstrate exactly how it's done. While Avner now was in that compromised position, Yoav takes a sword and kills him. Vayikusham al hachomesh. And where does Yoav hit Avner? In the fifth rib. Okay, vengeance to a T, if you will. And again, Yoav felt that he was justified in doing so. He felt he was a Goel Hadam. And so he hit him in the fifth rib. I'm Rav Yochanan Medofen Chamishas Makom Shamar Vekavetulim Bo. And for the second time in today's daf, it is the place of the intersection of the gallbladder and the liver. Ve'eshiv Hashem Estamo Al Rosho Asher Pagabishtei Anashim Tzadikim V'Tovim Mimenu. Now, fast forward to the beginning of Sefer Malachim, where now Yoav himself is being killed. And again, the Navi describes Yoav is being killed because he killed people who are greater than him. Meaning Yoav killed, now after today's daf, we know, Yoav killed Avner and he killed Amasa, and the Benayahu charges him, you know, you kill people, two people who are greater than you. And the Gemara goes on to explain. I'm sorry. So we already went over how Amasa darshan psukim in the Torah, and you, Yov, you didn't darshan those psukim. Tzadikim shein bepeh v'lo asu, v'hu bi'geres asa. They were asked to do things which are inappropriate. We are now describing the incident of sending Uriah to the front line. David HaMelech instructs the generals to send Uriah to the front line. So he asks Amasa to do so directly. Amasa said no. He sends a letter to Yoav to send Uriah to the front line, and Uriah does so. And Amasa lo nishmar b'cherev asher b'yad Yoav. I'm sorry. Let me just amplify this point a little bit better, and then we'll go on. And the point over here is that even though Yoav didn't receive verbal instruction, even though it was in a letter, he still followed the instructions, albeit the instructions were inappropriate. Okay, I understand what was Yoav supposed to do, but okay, that, you know, he was put into a conundrum. But the point is that Amasa was told directly to do it, he wouldn't do it. Yoav was just simply given written instruction to do so, and he complied, even though it was inappropriate. Amasa lo nishma b'cherev asher b'yad Yoav. Now, back to the actual killing. I know, it's just jumping around. Back to the actual killing of Yoav killing Avner. So, Avner didn't see it coming. Or at least that's what the pasuk describes. Sorry. I didn't mean Avner. I meant Amasa. Thank you. Amasa did not see it coming. Meaning this is now when Yoav actually kills Amasa. Amasa lo nishma b'cherev asher b'yad Yoav amarav shelo chashdu. Now, what does it mean he didn't see it coming? Meaning he didn't suspect that Yoav was going to kill him. Now, fast forward to Yoav was killed. So he was buried in the house in the desert. That's a strange language. The Gemara goes on to explain. So one explanation of the Gemara is that his house was hefker, meaning that the Aniyim were able to take from his possessions. Yoav, although was just tried by the Sanhedrin and put to death, but the Gemara says, but we're going to end off by saying positive things about Yoav. He never stole. He never was involved in Arayos. Meaning, despite the fact that there certainly was reason to kill him, but a full condemnation, not at all. In fact, not only not a full condemnation, but in other words, he lived in other aspects of his life a very meritorious life. Finally, Yoav supported others, he fed others, and the Gemara has a tradition that not only did he give the Aniyim bread and water, but he also gave them fish, the right dagim katanim. So, in other words, he was generous in terms of when he distributed to the poor. So again, positive words about Yoav to finish off this entire episode. Hadron Lach HaNigmar Adin, that is the end of the sixth parak of Sanhedrin. Tomorrow morning, Amir Hashem, we start the seventh parak.